forewarn you that today and tomorrow we're going to sort of mix the two themes together. We're talking about resistance to change and we're talking about conflict, and somehow those two go hand in glove. I'm not sure when I've crossed the line from dealing with resistance to change to dealing with conflict. So you just put whichever title you want to put on today's lesson and put the other title on tomorrow's lesson and figure out how to sort it out later on. My good friend Charles Seibert at Abilene Christian University has a practice of burying his tongue rather deeply in cheek and saying that there are really only three kinds of congregations. First of all, there are congregations in conflict. And secondly, there are congregations that are just coming out of conflict. And thirdly, there are congregations about to go into conflict. Well, as shepherds, I'm sure there are times you feel that those are the only three choices. That you're fighting a brush fire here or fighting a brush fire there and trying to delay the day in which things might get out of hand. But I'm a firm believer that we don't have to have a divided, warring fellowship. In fact, when we were first working with a title for my book, System Sensitive Leadership, the working title for a long time was, "We Don't Have to Fight." I think we need to send that message, that we don't have to fight. In the end, we ended up using the subtitle, "Empowering Diversity Without Polarizing the Church." We can't do anything about the diversity that's walking through our front doors. It is out there, it is going to continue to be out there, and I got news for you, it's going to become even greater in its breadth than it is already. So we are either going to close our doors or we're going to deal with diversity. People with different styles of worship they like, people with different preferences as to the kinds of Bible class teachers they want, people who have this preference for their preacher or that preference for their preacher and the way he presents the information. Those diversities are going to continue to be there. Our goal is to find a way to harmonize them so that strength rather than polarization comes. Now, I want to share a perspective with you. In my conversations with people who are feeling somewhat overwhelmed and inundated by the pressure for change and the resistance to change and the conflict that comes out of those two, I sometimes hear people saying, never before in the history of the church has a generation had to deal with as much change as we're dealing with. And if you define the history of the church as the last 200 years or the last 300 or 400 years, I might go along with you. But I want to suggest to you that no generation in the history of Christianity had to deal with more profound change than the generation in the book of Acts. We haven't touched the hem of the garment yet. They had to learn to overcome their smug ethnicity. They had to learn to join hands with people they didn't like. They had to re-examine all their religious scruples. They had to rethink what made a person part of God's covenant family. They had wholesale change to deal with. Now, there were times even they couldn't avoid conflict. I know that it's simplistically attractive to say, well, you know, if we all just worshiped Christ with the fullness of our being, and would just accept His Lordship as the driving force in our lives, we wouldn't have conflict with one another. But what about Paul and Barnabas? Have you ever known of any two Christians who were more committed to evangelism, more committed to the Lordship of Christ, more in love with what the kingdom is about than Paul and Barnabas? But they even got to the point where their differences on preference over a personnel issue became so pronounced, one had to go one way and one the other. At least they didn't go off and each start their own journal writing the other one up. There are times we can't work together. Perhaps our methodologies and our styles are too broadly separated. But just because we can't see eye to eye doesn't mean that we can't stand shoulder to shoulder. And that we can't support one another. And we need to start communicating that more and more to our congregations. Now then, when we are dealing with resistance to change, we are coming up against some of those things I was talking about yesterday when I spoke about what's going on underneath what's going on underneath what's going on. For those of you who weren't with me, I used the analogy of a modern man of war, a frigate or a cruiser equipped with guided missile launchers. And how uncluttered the upper deck is now compared to the days of the old 16-inchers and the 8-inch gun mounts, in which the superstructure was cluttered everywhere with armament and things in motion during a moment of combat. Today it's very sleek, very uncomplicated, because you don't want much in the environment when you're firing off missiles. And so it's very sleek, but beneath that deck, there's a lot going on. And you don't understand that ship until you understand what's going on beneath what's going on beneath what's going on. Well, the same is true with our people. When it comes time for us to talk about change, and we run into resistance of change, we must not look at the top deck. We've got to be able to look below what's going on to understand what the real issues are. Because one of the things that's real interesting in our brotherhood is people tend to have a penchant, whenever they disagree with someone on an item, to find a way to cast it into a doctrinal fight. And my experience is, most of the time, it's not a doctrinal fight. Doctrine is just the window dressing that we're using to justify a position we've taken on another basis. I'll be asked to come in and work with a conflicted situation in a congregation, and there will be one person or one party that is really objecting strongly to something on a biblical grounds, and we'll open the text and we'll study the text together, and I will lead them to an understanding that there are some other ways that this can be biblically done, and they seem to concur with that, and then the next thing I know they say, but what about this? And they start digging in on another biblical text on another issue. And we work patiently with that, and we get that behind us, and we're ready to go forward, I think. And then all of a sudden, they've moved over and they've dug in on another text. And after they do that to me 3 or 4 times, I begin to realize this is not a textual battle going on here. There is something else going on beneath what's going on. I wonder what the real issue is. And so I want to invite us as church leaders, as those who are shepherding congregations, to develop more and more skills to listen for the deeper issue. Now let me give you one simple structure within which to do this. And some of you already know this if you've had any training whatsoever in mediation of disputes, because this is a model that's widely used by those who are appointed by courts and those who are hired by warring parties to mediate differences. Our polarization, when someone promotes a change and there is resistance to that change, the polarization always zeroes in on a particular issue. And I know where you stand on that issue, and I know where I stand on this issue, and the issue is here between us, and we lob our artillery over the issue at one another. Okay? And that's typically what happens when we begin to deal with resistance to change. The artillery is now being lobbed over the issue. It becomes very important for us, first of all, to work with people who are resisting the change in such a way that I really understand what the issue is as they see it. In fact, if I'm dealing with someone who really is emotional about this, I'm going to ask them to write the issue down. Write down exactly what the issue is and do it succinctly. Try to do it in 25 words. If you can't reduce the issue down to 25 words, you may not be as clear about what the issue is as you think you are. So can you reduce this issue down to 25 words? I'd like that in writing so that I can be clear as to what the issue is. Now let me tell you, there's a second reason why you do that. You see, there are some people who just love the fight. And about the time you resolve the issue, you're going to discover the issue has shifted. You want them committed in writing that this is the issue, because you want to be able to come back later and hold them accountable. This is the issue. And as we then define the issue, at that point I want to stop talking about the issue. I want to put the issue aside for a moment. And what we want to do is to go beneath the surface, beneath what's going on, and start asking, okay, now I know what your stance on that issue is. What are the concerns you have that bring you to that position? I'm not interested in the position. I'm not interested in how you argue the position right now. I want to know, beneath that position, what are the concerns that bring you to that position? For instance, recently I was teaching a class on the role of women and was examining and re-examining some of the classic texts that we've looked at. And I was raising some questions about what these texts actually prohibit and what is it that they may empower us to allow women to do that we've just excluded women from. And there was one man, he's a good friend of mine. We have breakfast together several times a year. But I could see as I was monitoring his body language that this was a very disturbing presentation to him. He was not comfortable. And periodically he would speak up in the course of the discussion and say some things that were not typical of him. They were sort of rigid and sort of, this is the way it is and there's no other way to look at it. And so when this went on for quite a period of time, I began to direct some questions to him whose design was not to understand his position but to understand his concerns. You know what the concern was? He has several members of his family in various denominations who have moved to very liberal positions of where women can be used, and on the heels of that, then began to change their position on homosexuality. And he said, my fear is, now there's the problem, it's not an issue, it's a fear. My fear is that if we start broadening the ways in which we use women, it'll be 10 years from now and we won't have a stand on moral issues either. It's the old, you know, open the door and you let everything in argument. But the key thing was, my fear is. You see, I could have stood there for the next 3 hours and advanced the most compelling exegetical arguments imaginable to defend the position that I was taking, and it would have not touched his fear. What I had to do was park the issue and park the positions, his and mine, and say, now tell me what it is by way of concerns that drives you to be taking this position. Well, I tell you, whenever there is resistance to change in your congregation, behind the position that people are taking with you, there are some deeper things you need to know about. And the only way you're going to know about them is to listen intently and ask questions to which you're prepared just to listen, not respond immediately. I go back to what we said yesterday, and now we're going to start looping back and pulling some things forward to this discussion. One of the pitfalls for us as men, especially, who are leaders in the church, is that men are designed by the very nature of our acculturation as we are growing up, from the time we first start using language, to use language not to build community and collaboration and collegiality the way women do, but to build pecking order. Men combat with one another with language. Now, it's real simple to watch this. And it works completely different with men than it does with women. If you've got a group of men sitting around and one of them tells a joke and everybody laughs, what do you know is going to happen next? I mean, you can bet the ranch on it. Somebody else is going to try to tell a joke that is funnier. Because I can't bear letting him one-up me. I've got to have a funnier story than that. And then, as soon as the laughter dies down from that one, somebody else has got to come up with one. Or you get a group of men sitting around talking about their problems with their teenage kids. And one says, boy, my son is just really messed up. He's over here doing this and this. I don't know what to do. And you can just bet the ranch again. Somebody's going to say, well, you think that's a problem. You should see what I've got with my son. And now then it becomes a contest, not over who has the funniest story, but who's managing the most complex problem with his teenager. Can you hear the pecking order stuff in that? We men unconsciously are programmed, when we get in, particularly into charged communication, to spend a lot of our time not listening, but figuring out how I'm going to come out on top on this thing. I don't want to look stupid. I don't want to look uninformed. I don't want to look like I don't have it together. I've got to be thinking through how best to answer this so that I don't lose esteem. Now, I'm exaggerating, but not very much. As long as I am in conversation with someone zeroed in on how am I going to respond, guess what I'm not doing with that other person? I am not listening. I am not hearing what's going on. Oh, I'm seeing the superstructure all right. I can probably repeat back to them the words they said. But I'm not focused in on them and listening so that I pick up on the fears and the anxieties and the hurts and the uncertainties that are down underneath here that are driving the resistance that I'm dealing with. So again, as I said yesterday, we've got to become a people who get outside of ourselves when there is change and really try to get inside the moccasins of this person who is resistant to change. In understanding what's going on beneath what's going on, one of the most helpful set of models that I've come across were the ones that we reproduced in System Sensitive Leadership. This, of all the models that I've studied in 30 years of military and educational and political and church leadership responsibilities, helped me put things together in a frame of reference so that I could quickly size up the issues that were going on down underneath better than anything else I had ever come across. Because the model itself had been developed by a man who spent 30 years researching it and then died before he published. There was no place else in English you could go to get the model in print. So we spent 120 pages at the front of the book developing the model, which means it's a bit of a pedantic start. You've got to get to the last half before you get down to how do I deal with tension and how do I harmonize differences within my congregation. I would have loved to have left out the first 120 pages and just referred you to a book where you could find the model, but it wasn't available, so we went at it that way. But for those of you not familiar with the model we develop in here, it looks at the development of humanity and where we are today in terms of 8 different thinking systems, or 8 different worldviews, if you would, that are playing against one another in our society and around the globe, and they are playing out within your congregation. The conflict over change in churches of Christ today, and basically across the religious world. We wrote this book in religiously neutral language, denominationally neutral language, because we sensed that the issues were bigger than just the churches of Christ. Well, were we ever right on that? It's being taught now in Episcopalian seminaries. It's being taught in Adventist seminaries. It's being taught in American Baptist seminaries. This book has reached across the spectrum. And I get calls from people who haven't taken the time to read the biography in the back and don't know who I am or where I'm coming from, who, having read about half of the book, assume I'm one of them. Because it all sounds like stuff that's happening in their church, in their denomination, whatever. Well, what we're dealing with across the religious spectrum in the United States today is a particular struggle between 3 of the systems that we talk about in this book, systems 4, 5, and 6. And I want to describe for those of you who are not familiar with this language or this model what 4, 5, and 6 are about, and then move that into application here as we talk about how we deal with change to minimize the chance of conflict. If you want to understand system 4, have a mental picture of it, think of it as basically the church of the 50s. And think of it as a healthy church of the 50s. There were unhealthy churches in the 50s, and there were healthy churches in the 50s, just as there are unhealthy and healthy churches in the 90s. Unfortunately, the church of the 50s has sort of become a catchword to refer to a legalistic, unhealthy kind of church. And I grew up in one of those. It was not particularly healthy and was always finding something else to fight over, but there were a lot of healthy churches around. Think of a healthy 50s kind of church. System 4 is approaching the world with a concern that hedonism and impulsiveness and licentiousness and rebellion and violence and impulse are always just about to break out. And we've got to keep things under control. Therefore, we want strong authority figures at the top who make the decisions that everybody else falls in line behind, with a lot of rules and regulations to control everything so that the folk that would cause trouble know what the rules are, and there's strong accountability. It is the way the military runs. Lots of rules and regulations. The general makes the decision. I may think there's a better way to do it, but I'm a good soldier, so I salute and follow orders, because you certainly don't want chaos breaking out with everyone deciding to do his own thing, do you? And so we need good, healthy System 4 organizations. System 4 thinks of the world in rather black and white terms. Its motto is, if you're not for us, you're against us. And so, in a System 4 view of the world, there are no neutrals. We fought the Cold War from a System 4 mindset. We've now discovered since the Iron Curtain fell, the Marxists were doing the same thing. You see, we had the Western Bloc over here, and we had the Soviet Bloc over here, and then there were about 105 nations in between that called themselves the non-aligned nations. How did those of us in the Western Bloc think about the non-aligned nations? What were they really? They were a bunch of crypto commies who just didn't have the guts to say so, right? Well, now that the Iron Curtain has fallen and we can go into the archives of the former Soviet Union, we discover that over here in Moscow, they looked at the non-aligned nations and said, you know what they really are? A bunch of crypto capitalists who don't have the nerve to say so. You see? System 4 sees you as being either for us or you're against us. That's the way it is. It's black and white. The theology of a System 4 mind is pretty black and white. There are not any grays, or at least very few of them. Okay? And the reason that it has this tendency to see things as black and white is because it fears that the worst of humanity is about to break out at any moment if we don't keep things under control. System 5, which really began to emerge in churches of Christ at the time we started going into specialized ministries, youth ministries, education ministries, evangelism ministries, and we were hiring people with those specializations. And about the time we moved from the wrong side of the tracks in the little white frame building to the finest building on Church Row in town after town, System 5 is moving in at that point. And System 5 is the system that has driven the entrepreneurial spirit of the American experience. And System 5 has structure, and it has bottom line expectations, but it's into empowering people. Let me see if I can't give you some how-tos and turn you loose to go do it. And System 5 has driven our world so much that if you walk into the average bookstore today, just count the number of titles that begin with how-to, how-to, how-to. And if it's not the title, it's the subtitle. Okay? And that's about this giving people skills, insights, and cutting them loose to go get it done. There's not the emphasis on control. There is the emphasis on freedom. And how do you go at it? System 6 is the system that gives us the small group experience that is so common in our day, the self-help groups, the support groups. System 6 is what gives us the rights groups, the children's rights groups, the animal rights groups, the civil rights groups, the women's rights groups. Because what System 6 is about is healing a world that is filled with victims that the other systems have run roughshod over. And System 6 is into accepting and affirming and healing people. In System 6, when it moves into an organization, the hierarchy of the organization starts flattening immediately, because System 6 sees hierarchy and organization as becoming impersonal and uncaring. And System 6 wants to be concerned with the well-being of people and to help them, nurture them, to do whatever it takes for them to be able to cope and get back to where they're performing as they should. So when System 6 moves into corporate America, we immediately start stripping out middle management. And we start shortening the management stack. And we go to self-directed work teams. in which there's virtually no hierarchy, and you walk into that self-directed work team and you have to look around for a while to figure out who the manager is. And you walk into a System 6 Bible class, and how are they formed up? In a circle. There's no podium up front. There's no projector in the overhead. They're all sitting in a circle. And what are they doing? Everybody's sharing their experiences back and forth and hopefully ministering to one another as they share these stories. And again, you have to look at that group and watch it for a while to figure out who the teacher is in here, because he's not called a teacher anymore. What is he? He's a facilitator. He's facilitating their ministry to one another. Now, those three systems are all represented in most of our congregations, right? But let me come back and talk about how those systems respond to change. System 4 is the most guarded about change. And the reason it's guarded about change is because it is so afraid that if we let things get the least bit out of control, all chaos will break out around here. And so, 4 is willing to change. It has changed immensely over the centuries. System 4 came to prominence about the time of Jesus in the Roman Empire. And it ran unrivaled until the end of the 19th century. It wrote our American Constitution. It fought the Civil War for us. Because in System 4, every person is a person of worth and dignity, and their freedom of expression is to be protected because they are a person of worth and dignity. And so it is a very important system. And what it's particularly strong on is teaching truth. It wants to know what is the truth behind a thing, and let me align my life with that truth, and let me live completely in keeping with what is expected of me, whether it is God's truth or the nation's truth or the corporate organization's truth. I will take my place and I will follow faithfully as a dutiful servant. Now, it gives up the freedom to do its own thing in the interest of keeping order. That's why System 4 is so compliant. Is because it's afraid that if we aren't all compliant, all chaos is going to break out around here. So, guess what kind of students they are when you teach them? What kind of class does System 4 want? Exactly what we've got here. And as I look around, I see a lot of you that I know, and you ain't System 4s, and you're sitting there saying, I really wish we had time to interact on this, because System 5 wants to give and take. They like to play devil's advocate. They like to challenge the teacher. They like to say, where did you get that idea? Just to see if he can defend it. Because System 4 respects you as an authority simply because you've got the title. Well, I may know better how to fight this war than the general, but he's got the title, so I see that's no different than the guy down on the shop floor who knows how to do it better than the manager, but the manager's got the title on his door, so he gets to make the decision. System 4 respects authority simply because authority has the title. System 5 says, you've got to be kidding. I'll respect authority if it's credible. You're going to expect me to charge up that mountainside and take that pillbox if I don't think you know what you're doing, General? Not, it's my life. Now you show me that you're a credible leader and a credible strategist, and I'll think about charging up that hill and taking that pillbox. But just because you've got the title doesn't mean you're an authority. System 5 is much more into asking you to establish your credibility before it follows. And for those of us who are System 4 leaders, it looks like System 5 is rebellious. Because as System 4s, if the boss says do it, I'm ready to do it. So here I am as an elder, and I announce this change, and these System 5 people say, well, why would you do a thing like that? They ought to know that we're the leaders. We've been entrusted with leadership so that we can make these decisions for them. That's the way System 4 works. System 5 says, why didn't you consult us on that? You know, we've got some input. We've got a good head on our shoulders. We think we could see some better ways today. Why didn't you consult us? Don't you believe in us? Well, yeah, we believe in you, but we're the leaders. Well, I know that's your title, but have you really proven yourself as leaders? Are the kinds of leaders that I ought to respect? Now, I want to suggest to you that that is a critical question for System 5 if you as a leader are going to bring about change. You've got to have proven your credibility as a leader who is interested in their empowerment and their well-being. They will not accept you as a leader just because you have the title. And they won't accept the things you announce just because you announce them as a leader. There will be resistance to change there. System 6 is even more radical. And I'm using radical very liberally here, you know. I love System 6. I've got a lot of System 6 leaders in my congregation. When I mean radical, in the way that they challenge what it takes for you to be a credible leader. You've got to be credible in the eyes of System 6, but the way you establish credibility in System 6 is by being compassionate. They don't care how much you know or how many smarts you've got if they sense that you are not really a caring, compassionate person. They're more interested in having the heart of Jesus than the mind of Jesus. It's just the opposite with System 4. System 4 is after the mind of Jesus first and then the heart of Jesus. System 6 is after the heart first and then they go for the mind. They want acceptance and affirmation and a sense that you as a leader really care. However, now then we've come to something that is very important for us to understand, depending upon what system I'm coming from as a leader, as to how I package change. Because if I package change as a System 5 leader, I'm going to want a lot of options for people. System 5 loves options. We describe it in the book as the kind of system that buys a satellite dish to put on its roof so that it can pull 200 channels out of the sky and then buys a VCR so it can rent movies on weekends. System 5 wants more choices than it can possibly exercise. That's why when you go to the grocery store today, there are 200 brands of cereal. It's because they are marketing to this System 5 desire for lots of choices and lots of freedom to choose. So guess what? System 5 is into change as just something you do to create more options. And System 5 often doesn't think a lot about what the long-term implications of change would be. You see, Thomas Edison was one of the prototypes of System 5 thinking. You know, he made 15,000 attempts before he made the light bulb work. And 10,000 attempts into that, his assistants came to him and said, "Mr. Edison, don't you know that the physicists at MIT are saying that what we're trying to accomplish violates the laws of physics and can't be done? And we've tried 10,000 times and failed. Don't you think we should devote our resources and our money to something else?" Edison's immediate response, and this is the way System 5 looks at the world. Edison's immediate response was, "We haven't failed 10,000 times. We've merely learned 10,000 ways not to build a light bulb." Spy just loves to tinker and keep tinkering till it finds something that works. What does that look like to 4? It looks like change for the sake of change, and we don't know where we're going and there's nobody in control. That's what it looks like to 4. So to bring 4 along when we're changing, it's really essential that they know exactly what the limits of the change are going to be. One day, about 4 years ago, we could feel the muttering, the murmuring. We weren't making major changes. I mean, we were shuffling 2 or 3 chairs on the deck. But I had people walking up to me in the hallway and saying, "Well, do we even believe in baptism around here anymore?" See, when 4's fear that things are getting out of control gets stoked, it assumes that one change means wholesale change. And so we realized that we had to draw some lines to say to 4, "It's going to be safe here. This is still going to be your kind of church." And the elders simply went before the congregation and said, "We've been making some change in worship here. And we've heard that some of you are saying that this is the first step toward bringing in an instrument. Let it be known, we are not bringing in an instrument now or any time in the future. All right? Yes, we are bringing in instruments for weddings. If people want to do that, that's okay with us. But you come here on Sunday morning and Sunday night for the rest of your life and you're not going to have an instrument in this worship. Are we clear on that?" Yeah, they're clear on that. And you know what? We're really committed to evangelism. And we're going to teach that baptism is a key component of one's initial response to Christ, and we're not going to compromise on that. Are we clear on that? We're clear on that. Okay, we just wanted to be sure you were sure of that. And the muttering just sort of died down. Periodically, we have to come back and say to four, we're making this change, but here is where we're going to be. Now, this is one of the things that's important for us to keep in mind. One of the things that is different with four from five and six or any of the other systems downstream, please listen to this carefully. If you miss this, you miss something that is key to what's going on beneath what's going on. When system four is a person's primary system of dealing with the world, there is a strong tendency to denominationalize around the prevailing ideology and then to build one's sense of identity around a particular denominational expression. And I'm not talking just about Christianity. I'm talking about system four anywhere you apply it on the face of the globe. So when system four comes into Judaism, in modern Judaism, you get, I'm Orthodox, I'm Reform, I'm conservative. When it comes into Marxism, I am Leninist, I am Maoist, I am Stalinist. When it comes into American democracy, I am a Republican, I am Democrat. Hear that identity language? When it comes into Mohammedanism, I am Shiite, I am Sunni. When it comes into Christianity, I am Baptist, I am Methodist, I am Church of Christ. And don't you hear people use that language? I am Church of Christ. Listen to the identity language. Because if you build your sense of identity around this particular organized way of expressing your faith, and someone starts changing with the tinkering with the organization, tinkering with the way we do things, what are they threatening? They are threatening your identity. It's not just change of the way we do things around here. It is a threat to my identity. I have a very dear System 4 friend who said to me in a note that she wrote me with deep concern a few months ago, I am so upset with some of the things we are doing here because I could never bring my friends to this church anymore because I don't want them to think that this is what I am. Listen to that language. That is identity language. One of the things we have to be aware of is that System 4 people really have their whole sense of identity at times hooked into the way we've always done things. And that it's not just a matter of showing them a better way of doing it, it's a matter of showing them a better way of doing it and helping them maintain a good sense of identity in the process. That's a whole two-hour presentation. But do you understand the dynamic I'm talking about? Now, the problem is that System 5 loves to tinker, and System 6 just wants to accept everybody, and we want as few rules as possible in System 6, because I want to bring you in here and love you and just care for you, and I don't want you to have to be answerable to a lot of regulations. So 6 isn't too crazy about a lot of heavy guidelines that we've got to work within. And 5 and 6, not understanding this identity issue that's running in 4, see them as a bunch of Pharisees. See them as a bunch of legalists. See them as a bunch of spiritual deadwood. And they talk about them that way in some subtle ways that just pours more fire on the flame. For instance, we have outlawed in our congregation praise worship. We said, don't anybody ever use that term. Because across our brotherhood, what is a praise worship? What kind of music are you going to sing? Very contemporary, very System 5-6 kind of stuff. You're certainly not going to hear a Mighty Fortress is Our God very often. But, now put yourself within the frame of reference of System 4. When someone stands up and says, next Sunday night we're going to have a praise service, what does that say about your history as a worshiper who loves the great classical hymns of the faith? That you haven't been praising. That you haven't really been spiritual. That you really haven't been connected to the Lord. It is that kind of smug, unreflecting language that comes out of 5 and 6 sometimes that further polarizes four. Six has a real tendency in politics and in religion and everywhere else to become smugly arrogant. And the source of its smug arrogance is, we really have heart and you don't. So we're really the spiritual ones. We're really the Christ-like ones. They don't even realize they're doing it. This is going on outside their own conscious awareness. But boy, four picks up on it. Four picks up on it immediately and sees that arrogance and hears that smugness. That is what Rush Limbaugh is playing to every day on the air against the System 6 liberals that are his foil for his radio program. Listen to how many times he talks about the arrogance and the smugness and the elitism of their language. What he's picking up on is that tendency that is there in six. It doesn't have to be there in six. It is the same pitfall in six that legalism is in four. All of these systems have pitfalls. And you have to avoid the pitfall. That happens to be the pitfall of six. It's this subtle kind of arrogance. And so they really do think the church of the 50s was inferior. They really do think that strong authoritarian leadership is an inferior way to do it. They really feel that, and it comes out in the way they talk, until they are taught to have a respect for the strength that is there in other ways of looking at things. And our challenge, when we talk about this in the book, is getting all these systems to respect that each one brings a strength to the table. So how are we going to present change, and our time is gone, how are we going to present change so that System 4 does not feel threatened by it? Well, first of all, we've got to get System 5 to think through the change well enough that they can answer the reservations of 4. 5 and 6 are going to tend to come in and propose a change that they're going to propose sometimes in rather broad generalities, and you're going to say, well, what will that lead to? What's that going to look like 2 or 3 years downstream? And they'll say, well, we're not really sure. We're just going to keep fooling with this till we figure out how it works. And they're fine with that. That's the world they live in. That's the world that's made them a fortune as a capitalist or as an entrepreneur. Keep testing the market till you find what sells. But four can't be comfortable with that. So we have to help fives as leaders, before we go forward with their proposal for change, to think through who is going to lead this and where is it going to go and what is it going to look like 2 and 3 years downstream. And then we need to communicate that clearly to four. We're about to make this change in our Bible school programs. We're about to make this change in the way we do worship. We're about to make this change in the way we organize our life groups. And here is the reason for the change, and here's who's going to be guiding this. And you always put someone four has confidence in as guiding it. And this is the change. We're not going to do these things. We're not going to do these things. This is the limit. Get everybody clear as to what it is that we're going at. Now, this becomes particularly difficult if you happen to be dealing with some issue that is an identity issue for them. But this is fundamentally the approach we have to take. With six in particular, we have to get them to listen to their language carefully. Their words about spirituality and praise and having the heart of Jesus that can sometimes come across judgmentally toward four. Because what six has forgotten is that four built more orphans' homes than any other system. Four built more homes for the aged than any other system. Four built our humanitarian response system. Don't tell four it doesn't have a heart. Don't tell four it doesn't care. It simply packages that care in a different style from the way six packages its care. But many times what I find is going on behind the resistance to change is that four is super sensitive to the smugness and the superiority they're hearing from the way that six is presenting the proposal for change. Well, that's going to lead to conflict, which gets us to tomorrow. Same time, same station. If you want a copy of the book, it's available at College Press for $10. I've got some copies here. I'll sell them to you for the same price. If you don't know the book, I'd be willing for you to come up here and thumb through one and see if it's something that you think would be worthwhile. I'd be glad to answer any questions about it. Thank you much.